Back in the evening, Levin and his wife were drinking tea in their room when Marya Nikolaevna ran into them breathlessly. She was pale and her lips were quivering. "He is dying," she whispered. "I'm afraid he will die right away." Both of them ran to him. He was sitting raised up with one elbow on the bed, his long back bent and his head hanging low. "How do you feel?" Levin asked in a whisper after a silence. "I feel I'm setting off," Nikolai said with difficulty, but with extreme distinctness, deliberately squeezing the words out of himself. He did not raise his head, but simply turned his eyes upward without their reaching his brother's face. "Katya, go away," he added. Levin jumped up and with a peremptory whisper made her go out. "I'm setting off," he said again. "Why do you think so?" said Levin, so as to say something. "Because I'm setting off," he repeated, as though he had a liking for the phrase. "It's the end." Marya Nikolaevna went up to him. "You had better lie down. You'd be easier," she said. "I shall lie down soon enough," he pronounced slowly. "When I'm dead," he said sarcastically, wrathfully. "Well, you can put me down if you like." Levin laid his brother on his back, sat down beside him, and gazed at his face, holding his breath. The dying man lay with closed eyes, but the muscles twitched from time to time on his forehead, as with one thinking deeply and intensely. Levin involuntarily thought with him of what it was that was happening to him now, but in spite of all his mental efforts to keep him company, he saw by the expression of that calm, stern face and by the playing muscle above his brow that for the dying man there was growing clearer and clearer all that was still as dark as ever for Levin. "Yes, yes, so," the dying man articulated slowly at intervals. "Wait a little." He was silent again. "Right," he pronounced all at once, reassuringly, as though all were solved for him. "Oh, Lord," he murmured, and sighed deeply. Marya Nikolaevna felt his feet. "They're getting cold," she whispered. For a long while, a very long while, it seemed to Levin, the sick man lay motionless, but he was still alive, and from time to time he sighed. Levin by now was exhausted from mental strain. He felt that with no mental effort could he understand what it was that was right. He felt that he could not follow the dying man's thinking. He could not even think of the problem of death itself, but with no will of his own, thoughts kept coming to him of what he had to do next, closing the dead man's eyes, dressing him, ordering the coffin. And strange to say, he felt utterly cold, and was not conscious of sorrow nor of loss, less still of pity for his brother. If he had any feeling for his brother at that moment, it was rather envy for the knowledge the dying man had now, which he could not have. A long time more he sat over him so, continually expecting the end, but the end did not come. The door opened and Kitty appeared. Levin got up to stop her. But at the moment he was getting up, he caught the sound of the dying man stirring. "Don't go away," said Nikolai and held out his hand. Levin gave him his and angrily waved to his wife to go away. With the dying man's hand in his hand, he sat for half an hour, another hour. He did not think of death at all now. He wondered what Kitty was doing, who lived in the next room, whether the doctor lived in a house of his own. He longed for food and for sleep. He cautiously drew away his hand and felt the feet. The feet were cold, but the sick man was still breathing. Levin tried once more to move away on tiptoe, but the sick man stirred again and said, "Don't go." The dawn came. The sick man's condition was unchanged. Levin stealthily withdrew his hand and, without looking at the dying man, went off to his own room and went to sleep. When he woke up, instead of news of his brother's death, which he expected, he learned that the sick man had returned to his earlier condition. He had begun sitting up again, coughing, had begun eating again, talking again, and again had ceased to talk of death, again had begun to express hope of his recovery, and had become more irritable and gloomier than ever. No one, neither his brother nor Kitty, could soothe him. He was angry with everyone and said nasty things to everyone, reproached everyone for his sufferings, and insisted that they should get him a celebrated doctor from Moscow. To all inquiries made of him as to how he felt, he made the same answer with an expression of vindictive reproachfulness. I'm suffering horribly, intolerably. The sick man was suffering more and more, especially from bed sores, which it was impossible now to remedy, and grew more and more angry with everyone around him, blaming them for everything, and especially for not having brought him a doctor from Moscow. Kitty tried in every possible way to relieve him, to soothe him, but it was all in vain, and Levin saw that she herself was exhausted both physically and morally, though she would not admit it. The sense of death, which had been evoked in all by his taking leave of life on the night when he had sent for his brother, was broken up. Everyone knew that he must inevitably die soon, that he was half dead already. Everyone wished for nothing but that he should die as soon as possible, and everyone, concealing this, gave him medicines, tried to find remedies and doctors, and deceived him and themselves and one another. All this was falsehood, disgusting, irreverent deceit, and owing to the bent of his character, and because he loved the dying man more than anyone else did, Levin was most painfully conscious of this deceit. Levin, who had long been possessed of the idea of reconciling his brothers, at least in face of death, had written to his brother, Sergei Ivanovich, and having received an answer from him, he read this letter to the sick man. Sergei Ivanovich wrote that he could not come himself, and in touching terms he begged his brother's forgiveness. The sick man said nothing. What am I to write to him? Said Levin. I hope you are not angry with him. No, not in the least, Nikolai answered, vexed at the question. Tell him to send me a doctor. 3 more days of agony followed. The sick man was still in the same condition. The sense of longing for his death was felt by everyone now who saw him, by the waiters and the hotel keeper and all the people staying in the hotel and the doctor and Maria Nikolaevna and Levin and Kitty. The sick man alone did not express this feeling, but on the contrary was furious at their not getting him doctors, and went on taking medicine and talking of life. Only at rare moments when the opium gave him an instant's relief from his never-ceasing pain, he would sometimes, half asleep, utter what was ever more intense in his heart than in all the others. Oh, if it were only the end, or when will it be over? His suffering, steadily growing more intense, did their work and prepared him for death. There was no position in which he was not in pain. There was not a minute in which he was unconscious of it, not a limb, not a part of his body that did not ache and cause him agony. Even the memories, the impressions, the thoughts of his body awakened in him now the same aversion as the body itself. The sight of other people, their remarks, his own reminiscences, everything was for him a source of agony. Those about him felt this, and instinctively did not allow themselves to move freely, to talk, to express their wishes before him. All his life was merged in the one feeling of suffering and desire to be rid of it. There was evidently coming over him that revulsion which would make him look upon death as the goal of his desires, as happiness. Hitherto, each individual desire aroused by suffering or privation, such as hunger, fatigue, thirst, had been satisfied by some bodily function giving pleasure. But now no physical craving or suffering received relief, and the effort to relieve them only caused fresh suffering. And so all desires were merged in one, the desire to be rid of all his sufferings and their source, the body. But he had no words to express this desire of deliverance, and so he did not speak of it, and from habit, asked for the satisfaction of desires which could not now be satisfied. Turn me over on the other side, he would say, and immediately after he would ask to be turned back again as before. Give me some broth. Take away the broth. Talk of something. Why are you silent? And directly they began to talk, he would close his eyes and would show weariness, indifference, and loathing. On the 10th day from their arrival in the town, Kitty was unwell. She suffered from headache and sickness, and she could not get up all the morning. The doctor opined that the indisposition arose from fatigue and excitement and prescribed rest. After dinner, however, Kitty got up and went, as with her work, to the sick man. He looked at her sternly when she came in and smiled contemptuously when she said she had been unwell. That day he was continually blowing his nose and groaning piteously. "How do you feel?" she asked him. "Worse," he articulated with difficulty. "In pain." "In pain? Where?" "Everywhere." "It will be over today. You will see," said Marya Nikolaevna. Though it was said in a whisper, the sick man, whose hearing Levin had noticed was very keen, must have heard. Levin said, "Hush," to her, and looked round at the sick man. Nikolai had heard, but these words produced no effect on him. His eyes had still the same intense, reproachful look. "Why do you think so?" Levin asked her, when she had followed him into the corridor. "He has begun picking at himself," said Marya Nikolaevna. "How do you mean?" "Like this," she said, tugging at the folds of her woolen skirt. Levin noticed indeed that all that day the patient pulled at himself, as it were, trying to snatch something away. Marya Nikolaevna's prediction came true. Toward night the sick man was not able to lift his hands and could only gaze before him with the same intensely concentrated expression in his eyes. Even when his brother or Kitty bent over him so that he could see them, he looked just the same. Kitty sent for the priest to read the prayer for the dying. While the priest was reading it, the dying man did not show any sign of life. His eyes were closed. Levin, Kitty, and Marya Nikolaevna stood at the bedside. The priest had not quite finished reading the prayer when the dying man stretched, sighed, and opened his eyes. The priest, on finishing the prayer, put the cross to the cold forehead, then slowly returned it to the stand, and after standing in silence for 2 minutes more, he touched the huge, bloodless hand that was turning cold. "He is gone," said the priest, and would have moved away, but suddenly there was a faint stir in the mustaches of the dead man that seemed glued together, and quite distinctly in the hush they heard, from the bottom of the chest, the sharply defined sounds. "Not quite. Soon." And a minute later the face brightened, a smile came out under the mustaches, and the women who had gathered round began carefully laying out the corpse. The sight of his brother and the nearness of death revived in Levin that sense of horror in the face of the insolvable enigma, together with the nearness and inevitability of death that had come upon him that autumn evening when his brother had come to him. This feeling was now even stronger than before. Even less than before did he feel capable of apprehending the meaning of death, and its inevitability rose up before him more terrible than ever. But now, thanks to his wife's presence, that feeling did not reduce him to despair. In spite of death, he felt the need of life and love. He felt that love saved him from despair, and that his love, under the menace of despair, had become still stronger and purer. The one mystery of death, still unsolved, had scarcely passed before his eyes when another mystery had arisen, as insoluble, urging him to love and to life. The doctor confirmed his former suppositions in regard to Kitty. Her indisposition consisted of pregnancy. Chapter 21. From the moment when Alexey Alexandrovich understood from his interviews with Betsy and with Stepan Arkadyevich that all that was expected of him was to leave his wife in peace, without burdening her with his presence, and that his wife herself desired this, he felt so distraught that he could come to no decision by himself. He did not know himself what he wanted now, and putting himself in the hands of those who were so pleased to interest themselves in his affairs, he met everything with unqualified assent. It was only when Anna had left his house and the English governess sent to ask him whether she should dine with him or separately that for the first time he clearly comprehended his position and was appalled by it. Most difficult of all in this position was the fact that he could not in any way connect and reconcile his past with the present. It was not the past when he had lived happily with his wife that troubled him. The transition from that past to a knowledge of his wife's unfaithfulness he had already lived through miserably. That state had been painful, but he could understand it. If his wife had then, on declaring to him her unfaithfulness, left him, he would have been wounded, unhappy, but he would not have been in the hopeless position, incomprehensible to himself, in which he felt himself now. He could not now reconcile his immediate past, his tenderness, his love for his sick wife, and for the other man's child, with what was now the case, with the fact that, seemingly in return for all this, he now found himself alone, put to shame, a laughingstock, needed by no one, and despised by everyone. For the first 2 days after his wife's departure, Alexei Alexandrovich received petitioners and his head clerk, drove to the committee, and went down to dinner in the dining room as usual. Without giving himself a reason for what he was doing, he strained every nerve of his being for those 2 days, simply to preserve an appearance of composure and even of indifference. Answering inquiries about the disposition of Anna Arkadyevna's rooms and belongings, he had exercised immense self-control to appear like a man in whose eyes what had occurred was not unforeseen nor out of the ordinary course of events, and he attained his aim. No one could have detected in him any signs of despair. But on the second day after her departure, when Corney gave him a bill from a fashionable draper shop, which Anna had forgotten to pay, and announced that the shopman was waiting, Alexei Alexandrovich told him to show the man up. "Excuse me, Your Excellency, for venturing to trouble you, but if you direct us to apply to Her Excellency, would you graciously oblige us with her address?" Alexei Alexandrovich pondered, as it seemed, to the shopman, and all at once, turning round, he sat down to the table. Burying his head in his hands, he sat for a long while in that position, made several attempts to speak, and stopped short. Corney, perceiving his master's emotion, asked the shopman to call another time. Left alone, Alexei Alexandrovich realized that he had not the strength to keep up the role of firmness and composure any longer. He gave orders for the carriage that was awaiting him to be taken back and for no one to be admitted, and he did not go down to dinner. He felt that he could not endure the weight of universal contempt and exasperation which he had distinctly seen in the faces of the shopman and of Corney and of everyone without exception whom he had met during these 2 days. He felt that he could not turn aside from himself the hatred of men, because that hatred did not come from his being bad. In that case, he could have tried to be better, but from his being shamefully and repulsively unhappy. He knew that for this, for the very fact that his heart was torn with grief, they would be merciless to him. He felt that men would crush him as dogs strangle a mangled dog, yelping for pain. He knew that his sole means of security against people was to hide his wounds from them, and instinctively he tried to do this for 2 days, but now he felt incapable of keeping up the unequal struggle. His despair was even intensified by the consciousness that he was utterly alone in his sorrow. In all Petersburg, there was not a human being to whom he could express what he was feeling, who would feel for him, not as a high official, not as a member of society, but simply as a suffering man. Indeed, he had not such a one in the whole world. Alexei Alexandrovich grew up an orphan. There were two brothers. They did not remember their father, and their mother died when Alexei Alexandrovich was 10 years old. The property was a small one. Their uncle, Karenin, a government official of high standing, at one time a favorite of the late Tsar, had brought them up. On completing his high school and university courses with medals, Alexei Alexandrovich had, with his uncle's aid, immediately started in a prominent position in the service, and from that time forward he had devoted himself exclusively to political ambition. In the high school and the university, and afterward in the service, Alexei Alexandrovich had never formed a close friendship with anyone. His brother had been the person nearest to his heart, but he had a post in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and was always abroad, where he had died shortly after Alexei Alexandrovich's marriage. While he was governor of a province, Anna's aunt, a wealthy provincial lady, had brought him, middle-aged as he was, though young for a governor, together with her niece, and had succeeded in putting him in such a position that he had either to declare himself or to leave town. Alexei Alexandrovich hesitated a great while. There were at the time as many reasons for the step as against it, and there was no overbalancing consideration to outweigh his invariable rule of abstaining when in doubt. But Anna's aunt had, through a common acquaintance, insinuated that he had already compromised the girl, and that he was in honor bound to propose to her. He proposed, and concentrated on his betrothed and his wife all the feelings of which he was capable. The attachment he felt to Anna precluded in his heart every need of intimate relations with others. And now, among all his acquaintances, he had not one friend. He had plenty of so-called connections, but no friendships. Alexei Alexandrovich had plenty of people whom he could invite to dinner, to whose sympathy he could appeal in any public affair he was concerned about, whose interest he could reckon upon for anyone he wished to help, with whom he could candidly discuss other people's business and affairs of state. But his relations with these people were confined to one clearly defined channel, and had a certain routine from which it was impossible to depart. There was one man, a comrade of his at the university, with whom he had become friendly later, and with whom he could have spoken of a personal sorrow. But this friend had a post in the Department of Education in a remote part of Russia. Of the people in Petersburg, the most intimate and most likely were his head clerk and his doctor. Mikhail Vasilievich Sludin, the head clerk, was a straightforward, intelligent, good-hearted, and conscientious man, and Alexei Alexandrovich was aware of his personal goodwill. But their 5 years of official work together seemed to have put a barrier between them that cut off former relations. After signing the papers brought him, Alexei Alexandrovich had sat for a long while in silence, glancing at Mikhail Vasilievich, and several times he attempted to speak, but could not. He had already prepared the phrase, "You have heard of my trouble?" But he ended by saying as usual, "So, you'll get this ready for me?" And with that, dismissed him. The other person was the doctor, who had also a kindly feeling for him, but there had long existed a silent understanding between them that both were weighed down by work and always in a hurry. Of his women friends, foremost among them was Countess Lydia Ivanovna. Alexei Alexandrovich never thought. All women, simply as women, were terrible and distasteful to him. Chapter 22. Alexei Alexandrovich had forgotten the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, but she had not forgotten him. At the bitterest moment of his lonely despair, she came to him, and without waiting to be announced, walked straight into his study. She found him as he was sitting with his head in both hands. "Fay Forest Lakansani," she said, walking in with rapid steps and breathing hard with excitement and rapid exertion. "I have heard all. Alexei Alexandrovich, dear friend," she went on, warmly squeezing his hand in both of hers and gazing with her fine pensive eyes into his. Alexei Alexandrovich, frowning, got up, and disengaging his hand, moved a chair up for her. "Won't you sit down, Countess?" "I'm seeing no one because I'm unwell, Countess," he said, and his lips twitched. "Dear friend," repeated Countess Lydia Ivanovna, never taking her eyes off of his, and suddenly her eyebrows rose at the inner corners, describing a triangle on her forehead, her ugly yellow face becoming still uglier. But Alexei Alexandrovich felt she was sorry for him and was preparing to cry. And he, too, was softened. He snatched her plump hand and proceeded to kiss it. "Dear friend," she said in a voice breaking with emotion, "you ought not to give way to grief. Your sorrow is a great one, but you ought to find consolation." "I am crushed. I am annihilated. I am no longer a man," said Alexei Alexandrovich, letting go her hand but still gazing into her brimming eyes. "My position is so awful because I can find nowhere. I cannot find within me strength to support me." "You will find support. Seek it. Not in me, though I beseech you to believe in my friendship," she said with a sigh. Our support is love, that love that he has vouchsafed us. His burden is light, she said, with the look of ecstasy Alexei Alexandrovich knew so well. He will be your support and your succor. Although there was in these words a flavor of that sentimental emotion at her own lofty feelings and that new mystical fervor which had lately gained ground in Petersburg and which seemed to Alexei Alexandrovich disproportionate, still, it was pleasant to him to hear this now. I am weak. I am crushed. I foresaw nothing, and now I understand nothing. Dear friend, repeated Lydia Ivanovna, it's not the loss of what I no longer have. It's not that, pursued Alexei Alexandrovich. I do not grieve for that, but I cannot help feeling ashamed before other people for the position I am placed in. It is wrong, but I can't help it. I can't help it. It was not you who performed that noble act of forgiveness at which I was moved to ecstasy and everyone else too, but he, working within your heart, said Countess Lydia Ivanovna, raising her eyes rapturously. And so you cannot be ashamed of your act. Alexei Alexandrovich knit his brows, and crooking his hands, he cracked his fingers. One must know all the details, he said in his high voice. A man's strength has its limits, Countess, and I have reached my limits. The whole day I have had to be making arrangements, arrangements about household matters arising, he emphasized the word arising, from my new solitary position. The servants, the governess, the accounts. These pinpricks have stabbed me to the heart, and I have not the strength to bear it. At dinner, yesterday, I was almost getting up from the dinner table. I could not bear the way my son looked at me. He did not ask me the meaning of it all, but he wanted to ask, and I could not bear the look in his eyes. He was afraid to look at me, but that is not all. Alexei Alexandrovich would have referred to the bill that had been brought him, but his voice shook and he stopped. That bill on blue paper for a hat and ribbons, he could not recall without a rush of self-pity. I understand, dear friend, said Lydia Ivanovna. I understand it all. Succor and comfort you will find not in me, though I have come only to aid you if I can. If I could take from off you all these petty, humiliating cares, I understand that a woman's word, a woman's superintendence is needed. You will entrust it to me? Silently and gratefully, Alexei Alexandrovich squeezed her hand. Together we will take care of Seryosha. Practical affairs are not my strong point, but I will set to work. I will be your housekeeper. Don't thank me. I do it not for myself. I cannot help thanking you. But, dear friend, do not give way to the feeling of which you spoke, being ashamed of what is the Christian's highest glory. He who humbles himself shall be exalted. And you cannot thank me. You must thank him and pray to him for succor. In him alone we find peace, consolation, salvation, and love, she said. And turning her eyes heavenward, she began praying, as Alexei Alexandrovich gathered from her silence. Alexei Alexandrovich listened to her now, and those expressions which had seemed to him, if not distasteful, at least exaggerated, now seemed to him natural and consolatory. Alexei Alexandrovich had disliked this new enthusiastic fervor. He was a believer who was interested in religion primarily in its political aspect, and the new doctrine which ventured upon several new interpretations, just because it paved the way to discussion and analysis, was in principle disagreeable to him. He had hitherto taken up a cold and even antagonistic attitude to this new doctrine, and with Countess Lydia Ivanovna, who had been carried away by it, he had never argued, but by silence had assiduously parried her attempts to provoke him into argument. Now for the first time he heard her words with pleasure and did not inwardly oppose them. I am very, very grateful to you, both for your deeds and for your words, he said when she had finished praying. Countess Lydia Ivanovna once more squeezed both of her friend's hands. Now I will enter upon my duties, she said with a smile after a pause as she wiped away the traces of her tears. I am going to Seryosha. Only in the last extremity shall I apply to you, and she got up and went out. Countess Lydia Ivanovna went into Seryosha's part of the house and dropping tears on the scared child's cheeks, she told him that his father was a saint and his mother was dead. Countess Lydia Ivanovna kept her promise. She did actually take upon herself the care of the organization and management of Alexei Alexandrovich's household. But she had not overstated the case when saying that practical affairs were not her strong point. All her arrangements had to be modified because they could not be carried out. And they were modified by Corny, Alexei Alexandrovich's valet, who, though no one was aware of the fact, now managed Karenin's household and quietly and discreetly reported to his master, while the latter was dressing, all that was necessary for him to know. But Lydia Ivanovna's help was nonetheless real. She gave Alexei Alexandrovich moral support in the consciousness of her love and respect for him, and still more, as it was soothing to her to believe, by having almost turned him to Christianity. That is, from an indifferent and apathetic believer, she had turned him into an ardent and steadfast adherent of the new interpretation of Christian doctrine, which had been gaining ground of late in Petersburg. It was easy for Alexei Alexandrovich to believe in this teaching. Alexei Alexandrovich, like Lydia Ivanovna indeed, and others who shared their views, was completely devoid of profundity of imagination. That spiritual faculty in virtue of which the ideas evoked by the imagination become so actual that they must needs be in harmony with other ideas and with reality itself. He saw nothing impossible and absurd in the idea that death, though existing for unbelievers, did not exist for him, and that, as he was possessed of the most perfect faith, of the measure of which he was himself the judge, there was therefore no sin in his soul, and he was experiencing complete salvation here on earth. It is true that the erroneousness and shallowness of this conception of his faith was dimly perceptible to Alexei Alexandrovich, and he knew that when, without the slightest idea that his forgiveness was the action of a higher power, he had surrendered directly to the feeling of forgiveness, he had felt more happiness than now when he was thinking every instant that Christ was in his heart, and that in signing official papers he was doing his will. But for Alexei Alexandrovich, it was a necessity to think in that way. It was such a necessity for him in his humiliation to have some elevated standpoint, however imaginary, from which, looked down upon by all, he could look down on others, that he clung, as to his one salvation, to his delusion of salvation. Chapter 23. The Countess Lydia Ivanovna had, as a very young and enthusiastic girl, been married to a wealthy man of high rank, a very good-natured, jovial, and extremely dissipated rake. One month after marriage, her husband abandoned her, and her enthusiastic protestations of affection he met with an irony and even hostility which people, knowing the Count's good heart and seeing no defects in the enthusiastic Lydia, were at a loss to explain. Though they were divorced and lived apart, yet whenever the husband met the wife, he invariably behaved to her with the same malignant irony, the cause of which was incomprehensible. Countess Lydia Ivanovna had long given up being in love with her husband, but from that time she had never given up being in love with someone. She was in love with several people at once, both men and women. She had been in love with almost everyone who had been particularly distinguished in any way. She was in love with all the new princes and princesses who married into the imperial family. She had been in love with one archbishop, one vicar, and one parish priest. She had been in love with one journalist, three Slavophils with Komissarov, with one minister, one doctor, one English missionary, and Karenin. All these passions, constantly waning or growing more ardent, did not prevent her from keeping up the most extended and complicated relations with the court and fashionable society. But from the time that, after Karenin's trouble, she had taken him under special protection, from the time that she had set to work in Karenin's household looking after his welfare, she felt that all her other attachments were not the real thing, and that she was now genuinely in love, and with no one but Karenin. The feeling she now experienced for him seemed to her stronger than any of her former feelings. Analyzing her feeling and comparing it with former passions, she distinctly perceived that she would not have been in love with Kamizarov if he had not saved the life of the Tsar, that she would not have been in love with Ristich Kujitsky if there had been no Slavonic question, but that she loved Karenin for himself, for his lofty, uncomprehended soul, for the sweet to her high notes of his voice, for his drawling intonation, his weary eyes, his character, and his soft white hands with their swollen veins. She was not simply overjoyed at meeting him, but she saw in his face signs of the impression she was making on him. She tried to please him, not by her words only, but in her whole person. For his sake it was that she now lavished more care on her dress than before. She caught herself in reveries on what might have been, if she had not been married and he had been free. She blushed with emotion when he came into the room. She could not repress a smile of rapture when he said anything amiable to her. For several days now, Countess Lydia Ivanovna had been in a state of intense excitement. She had learned that Anna and Vronsky were in Petersburg. Alexei Alexandrovich must be saved from seeing her. He must be saved even from the torturing knowledge that that awful woman was in the same town with him, and that he might meet her at any minute. Lydia Ivanovna made inquiries through her friends as to what those shocking people, as she called Anna and Vronsky, intended doing, and she endeavored so to guide every movement of her friend during those days that he might not come across them. The young adjutant, a friend of Vronsky, through whom she obtained her information, and who hoped, through Countess Lydia Ivanovna, to obtain a concession, told her that they had finished their business and were going away next day. Lydia Ivanovna had already begun to calm down when the next morning a note was brought her, the handwriting of which she recognized with horror. It was the handwriting of Anna Karenina. The envelope was of paper as thick as bast. On the oblong yellow paper there was a huge monogram, and the letter smelt of agreeable scent. Who brought it? The commissionaire from the hotel. It was some time before Countess Lydia Ivanovna could sit down to read the letter. Her excitement brought on an attack of asthma to which she was subject. When she had recovered her composure, she read the following letter in French. Madame Leconte, the Christian feelings with which your heart is filled give me the, I feel, unpardonable boldness to write to you. I am miserable at being separated from my son. I entreat permission to see him once before my departure. Forgive me for recalling myself to your memory. I apply to you and not to Alexei Alexandrovich, simply because I do not wish to cause that generous man to suffer in remembering me. Knowing your friendship for him, I know you will understand me. Could you send Seriosha to me, or should I come to the house at some fixed hour, or will you let me know when and where I could see him away from home? I do not anticipate a refusal, knowing the magnanimity of him with whom it rests. You cannot conceive the craving I have to see him, and so cannot conceive the gratitude your help will arouse in me. In this letter exasperated Countess Lydia Ivanovna, its contents and the allusion to magnanimity, and especially its free and easy, as she considered, tone. "Say that there is no answer," said Countess Lydia Ivanovna, and immediately opening her blotting book, she wrote to Alexei Alexandrovich that she hoped to see him at 1 o'clock at the levee. "I must talk with you of a grave and painful subject. There we will arrange where to meet. Best of all at my house, where I will order tea as you like it. Urgent. He lays the cross, but he gives the strength to bear it," she added, so as to give him some slight preparation. Countess Lydia Ivanovna usually wrote some 2 or 3 letters a day to Alexei Alexandrovich. She enjoyed that form of communication which gave opportunity for a refinement and air of mystery not afforded by their personal interviews. Chapter 24. The levee was drawing to a close. People met as they were going away and gossiped of the latest news, of the newly bestowed honors and the changes in the positions of the higher functionaries. If only Countess Maria Borisovna were Minister of War and Princess Vetkovsky were Commander-in-Chief, said a gray-headed little old man in a gold-embroidered uniform, addressing a tall, handsome maid of honor who had questioned him about the new appointments. And if I were one of the adjutants, said the maid of honor, smiling, you have an appointment already. You're over the ecclesiastical department, and your assistant's Karenin. Good day, Prince, said the little old man to a man who came up to him. What were you saying of Karenin? Said the prince. He and Putyatov have received the order of Alexander Nevsky. I thought he had it already. No, just look at him, said the little old man, pointing with his embroidered hat to Karenin in a court uniform, with a new red ribbon across his shoulders, standing in the doorway of the hall with an influential member of the Imperial Council. Pleased and happy as brass, he added, stopping to shake hands with a handsome gentleman of the bedchamber of colossal proportions. No, he's looking older, said the gentleman of the bedchamber, from overwork. He's always drawing up projects nowadays. He won't let a poor devil go nowadays till he's explained it all to him under heads. Looking older, did you say? Il fait des passions. I believe Countess Lydia Ivanovna's jealous now of his wife. Oh, come now, please don't say any harm of Countess Lydia Ivanovna. Why, is there any harm in her being in love with Karenin? But is it true Madame Karenin's here? Well, not here in the palace, but in Petersburg. I met her yesterday with Alexei Vronsky. Brass de sus, Anna Morzaika. C'est un homme qui n'en passe. A gentleman of the bedchamber was beginning, but he stopped to make room, bowing for a member of the imperial family to pass. Thus people talk incessantly of Alexei Alexandrovich, finding fault with him and laughing at him, while he, blocking up the way of the member of the imperial council he had captured, was explaining to him point by point his new financial project, never interrupting his discourse for an instant for fear he should escape. Almost at the same time that his wife left Alexei Alexandrovich, there had come to him that bitterest moment in the life of an official, the moment when his upward career comes to a full stop. This full stop had arrived, and everyone perceived it, but Alexei Alexandrovich himself was not yet aware that his career was over. Whether it was due to his feud with Stremov, or his misfortune with his wife, or simply that Alexei Alexandrovich had reached his predestined limits, it had become evident to everyone in the course of that year that his career was at an end. He still filled a position of consequence. He sat on many commissions and committees, but he was a man whose day was over and from whom nothing was expected. Whatever he said, whatever he proposed, was heard as though it were something long familiar and the very thing that was not needed. But Alexei Alexandrovich was not aware of this and, on the contrary, being cut off from direct participation in governmental activity, he saw more clearly than ever the errors and defects in the action of others, and thought it his duty to point out means for their correction. Shortly after his separation from his wife, he began writing his first note on the new judicial procedure, the first of the endless series of notes he was destined to write in the future. Alexei Alexandrovich did not merely fail to observe his hopeless position in the official world. He was not merely free from anxiety on this head. He was positively more satisfied than ever with his own activity. He that is married careth for the things of the world, how he may please his wife. He that is unmarried careth for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord, says the Apostle Paul. And Alexei Alexandrovich, who was now guided in every action by Scripture, often recalled this text. It seemed to him that ever since he had been left without a wife, he had, in these very projects of reform, been serving the Lord more zealously than ever. The unmistakable impatience of the member of the council trying to get away from him did not trouble Alexei Alexandrovich. He gave up his exposition only when a member of the council, seizing his chance when one of the imperial family was passing, slipped away from him. Left alone, Alexei Alexandrovich looked down, collecting his thoughts, then looked casually about him and walked toward the door, where he hoped to meet Countess Lydia Ivanovna. And how strong they all are, how sound physically, thought Alexei Alexandrovich, looking at the powerfully built gentleman of the bedchamber with his well-groomed perfume whiskers and at the red neck of the prince pinched by his tight uniform. He had to pass them on his way. Truly it is said that all the world is evil, he thought, with another sidelong glance at the calves of the gentleman of the bedchamber. Moving forward deliberately, Alexei Alexandrovich bowed with his customary air of weariness and dignity to the gentleman who had been talking about him, and looking toward the door, his eyes sought Countess Lydia Ivanovna. "Ah, Alexei Alexandrovich," said the little old man, with a malicious light in his eyes at the moment when Karenin had come up to them and was nodding with a frigid gesture. "I haven't congratulated you yet," said the old man, pointing to his newly received ribbon. "Thank you," answered Alexei Alexandrovich. "What an exquisite day today," he added, laying emphasis in his peculiar way on the word exquisite. That they laughed at him, he was well aware, but he did not expect anything but hostility from them. He was used to that by now. Catching sight of the yellow shoulders of Lydia Ivanovna jutting out above her corset and her fine pensive eyes summoning him to her, Alexei Alexandrovich smiled, revealing untarnished white teeth, and went toward her. Lydia Ivanovna's dress had cost her great pains, as indeed all her dresses had done of late. Her aim in dress was now quite the reverse of what she had pursued 30 years before. Then her desire had been to adorn herself with something, and the more adorned the better. Now, on the contrary, she was perforce decked out in a way so inconsistent with her age and her figure that her one anxiety was to contrive that the contrast between these adornments and her own exterior should not be too appalling. And as far as Alexei Alexandrovich was concerned, she succeeded, and was in his eyes attractive. For him, she was the one island not only of goodwill to him, but of love in the midst of the sea of hostility and jeering that surrounded him. Passing through rows of ironical eyes, he was drawn as naturally to her loving glance as a plant to the sun. "I congratulate you," she said to him, her eyes on his ribbon. Suppressing a smile of pleasure, he shrugged his shoulders, closing his eyes as though to say that that could not be a source of joy to him. Countess Lydia Ivanovna was very well aware that it was one of his chief sources of satisfaction, though he never admitted it. "How is our angel?" said Countess Lydia Ivanovna, meaning Seriosha. "I can't say I was quite pleased with him," said Alexei Alexandrovich, raising his eyebrows and opening his eyes. "And Sitnikov is not satisfied with him." Sitnikov was the tutor to whom Seriosha's secular education had been entrusted. "As I have mentioned to you, there's a sort of coldness in him toward the most important questions which ought to touch the heart of every man and every child." Alexei Alexandrovich began expounding his views on the sole question that interested him outside the service, the education of his son. When Alexei Alexandrovich, with Lydia Ivanovna's help, had been brought back anew to life and activity, he felt it his duty to undertake the education of the son left in his hands. Having never before taken any interest in educational questions, Alexei Alexandrovich devoted some time to the theoretical study of the subject. After reading several books on anthropology, education, and didactics, Alexei Alexandrovich drew up a plan of education, and engaging the best tutor in Petersburg to superintend it, he set to work, and the subject continually absorbed him. "Yes, but the heart. I see in him his father's heart, and with such a heart a child cannot go far wrong," said Lydia Ivanovna with enthusiasm. "Yes, perhaps. As for me, I do my duty. It's all I can do." "You're coming to me," said Countess Lydia Ivanovna after a pause. "We have to speak of a subject painful for you. I would give anything to have spared you certain memories, but others are not of the same mind. I have received a letter from her, She is here in Petersburg. Alexei Alexandrovich shuddered at the allusion to his wife, but immediately his face assumed the death-like rigidity which expressed utter helplessness in the matter. "I was expecting it," he said. Countess Lydia Ivanovna looked at him ecstatically, and tears of rapture at the greatness of his soul came into her eyes. Chapter 25. When Alexei Alexandrovich came into the Countess Lydia Ivanovna's snug little boudoir, decorated with old china and hung with portraits, the lady herself had not yet made her appearance. She was changing her dress. A cloth was laid on a round table, and on it stood a china tea service and a silver tea kettle and spirit lamp. Alexei Alexandrovich looked idly about at the endless familiar portraits which adorned the room, and then, sitting down at the table, he opened a New Testament lying upon it. The rustle of the Countess's silk skirt drew his attention off. "Well, now we can sit quietly," said Countess Lydia Ivanovna, slipping hurriedly with an agitated smile between the table and the sofa, "and talk over our tea." After some words of preparation, Countess Lydia Ivanovna, breathing hard and flushing crimson, gave into Alexei Alexandrovich's hand the letter she had received. After reading the letter, he sat a long while in silence. "I don't think I have the right to refuse her," he said timidly, lifting his eyes. "Dear friend, you never see evil in anyone. On the contrary, I see all that is evil. But whether it is just," his face showed irresolution and a seeking for counsel, support, and guidance in a matter he did not understand. "No," Countess Lydia Ivanovna interrupted him. "There are limits to everything. I can understand immorality," she said, not quite truthfully, since she never could understand that which leads women to immorality. "But I don't understand cruelty. To whom? To you. How can she stay in town where you are? No, the longer one lives, the more one learns, and I'm learning to understand your loftiness and her baseness." "Who is to cast a stone?" said Alexei Alexandrovich, unmistakably pleased with the part he had to play. "I have forgiven all, and so I cannot deprive her of what is exacted by love in her, by her love for her son." "But is that love, my friend? Is it sincere? Admitting that you have forgiven, that you forgive, have we the right to work on the soul of that angel? She looks on her as dead. He prays for her and beseeches God to have mercy on her sins, and it is better so. But now what will he think?" "I had not thought of that," said Alexei Alexandrovich, evidently agreeing. Countess Lydia Ivanovna hid her face in her hands and was silent. She was praying. "If you ask my advice," she said, having finished her prayer and uncovered her face, "I do not advise you to do this. Do you suppose I don't see how you are suffering, how this has torn open your wounds? But supposing that, as always, you don't think of yourself, what can it lead to? To fresh suffering for you, to torture for the child. If there were a trace of humanity left in her, she ought not to wish it herself. No, I have no hesitation in saying I advise against it. And if you will entrust it to me, I will write to her." And Alexei Alexandrovich consented, and Countess Lydia Ivanovna sent the following letter in French. "Dear Madam, to be reminded of you might result in your son's asking questions, which could not be answered without implanting in the child's soul a spirit of censure toward what should be for him sacred. And therefore I beg you to interpret your husband's refusal in the spirit of Christian love. I pray to Almighty God to have mercy on you. Countess Lydia." This letter attained the secret object which Countess Lydia Ivanovna had concealed from herself. It wounded Anna to the quick. For his part, Alexei Alexandrovich, on returning home from Lydia Ivanovna's, could not all that day concentrate himself on his usual pursuits and find that spiritual peace of one saved and believing which he had felt of late. The thought of his wife, who had so greatly sinned against him, and toward whom he had been so saintly, as Countess Lydia Ivanovna had so justly told him, ought not to have troubled him. But he was not easy. He could not understand the book he was reading. He could not drive away harassing recollections of his relations with her, of the mistake which, as it now seemed, he had made in regard to her. The memory of how he had received her confession of infidelity on their way home from the races, especially his having insisted only on the observance of external decorum and not having sent a challenge, tortured him like a remorse. He was tortured, too, by the thought of the letter he had written her, and most of all his forgiveness, which nobody wanted, and his care of the other man's child, seared his heart with shame and remorse. And just the same feeling of shame and remorse he felt now as he reviewed all his past with her, recalling the awkward words in which, after long wavering, he proposed to her. "But how have I been to blame?" he said to himself, and this question always excited another question in him, whether they felt differently. Did their loving and marrying differently, these Vronskys and Oblonskys, these gentlemen of the bedchamber with their fine calves, and there passed before his mind a whole series of these succulent, vigorous, self-confident men who always and everywhere drew his inquisitive attention in spite of himself. He tried to dispel these thoughts. He tried to persuade himself that he was not living for this transient life, but for the life of eternity, and that there was peace and love in his heart. But the fact that he had in this transient, trivial life made, as it seemed to him, a few trivial mistakes, tortured him as though the eternal salvation in which he believed had no existence. But this temptation did not last long, and soon there was reestablished once more in Alexei Alexandrovich's soul the peace and the loftiness by virtue of which he could forget what he did not want to remember. Chapter 26. "Well, Kapitanych," said Seryozha, coming back rosy and good-humored from his walk the day before his birthday, and giving his Russian-plated overcoat to the tall old hall porter, who smiled down at the little person from the height of his long figure. "Well, has the bandaged official been here today? Did Papa see him?" "He saw him. The minute the head clerk came out, I announced him," said the hall porter with good-humored wink. "Here, I'll take it off." "Seryozha," said his Slavic tutor, stopping in the doorway leading to the inner rooms, "take it off yourself." But Seryozha, though he heard the tutor's feeble voice, did not pay attention to it. He stood keeping hold of the hall porter's shoulder knot and gazing into his face. "Well, and did Papa do what he wanted for him?" The hall porter nodded his head affirmatively. The bandaged official, who had already been 7 times to ask some favor of Alexei Alexandrovich, interested both Seryozha and the hall porter. Seryozha had come upon him in the hall and had heard him plaintively beg the hall porter to announce him, saying that he and his children had death staring them in the face. Since then, Seryozha, having met him a second time in the hall, took great interest in him. "Well, was he very glad?" he asked. "Glad, I should think so, almost dancing as he walked away." "And has anything been left for me?" asked Seryozha after a pause. "Come, sir," said the hall porter. Then, with a shake of his head, he whispered, "Something from the Countess." Seryozha understood at once that what the hall porter was speaking of was a present from Countess Lydia Ivanovna for his birthday. "You don't say. Where?" "Corny took it to your papa. A fine plaything it must be, too." "How big? Like this?" "Rather small, but a fine thing." "A book?" "No, something else. Run along, run along. Vasily Lukitch is calling you," said the porter, hearing the tutor's steps approaching and carefully taking away from his shoulder knot the little hand in the glove half pulled off. He indicated with his head Lukitch, the tutor. "Vasily Lukitch, I'm coming in one tiny minute," answered Seryozha, with gay and loving smile which always won over the careful Vasily Lukitch. Seryozha was too happy. Everything was too delightful for him to be able to help sharing with his friend, the porter, the family good fortune, of which he had heard from Lydia Ivanovna's niece during his walk in the public gardens. This piece of good news seemed to him particularly important, from its coming at the same time with the joy of the bandaged official, and his own joy at toys having come for him. It seemed to Seryozha that this was a day on which everyone ought to be glad and happy. "You know Papa's received the order of Alexandra Nevsky today?" To be sure I do. People have already been here to congratulate him. And is he glad? Glad at the Tsar's gracious favor? I should think so. It's a proof he's deserved it, said the porter sternly and seriously. Seriosha fell to musing, gazing up at the face of the porter, which he had thoroughly studied in every detail, especially at his chin, which hung down between the gray whiskers, never seen by anyone but Seriosha, who saw him only from below. Well, and has your daughter been to see you lately? The porter's daughter was a ballet dancer. When is she to come on weekends? They've their lessons to learn, too, and you've your lessons, sir. Run along. On coming into the room, Seriosha, instead of sitting down to his lessons, told his tutor of his supposition that what had been brought him must be a toy railway. What do you think? He inquired. But Vasily Lukitch was thinking of nothing but the necessity of learning the grammar lesson for the teacher, who was coming at 2. No, do just tell me, Vasily Lukitch, he said suddenly when he was seated at their work table with the book in his hands. What is greater than the Alexander Nevsky? You know Papa's received the Alexander Nevsky. Vasily Lukitch replied that the Vladimir was greater than the Alexander Nevsky. And higher still? Well, highest of all is the Andrei Vazvani. And higher than the Andrei? I don't know. What? You don't know? And Seriosha, leaning on his elbows, sank into deep meditation. His meditations were of the most complex and diverse character. He imagined his father's having been suddenly presented with both the Vladimir and the Andrei today, and in consequence being much better tempered at his lesson, and dreamed how, when he had grown up, he would himself receive all the orders, and what might be invented higher than the Andrei. Directly any higher order were invented, he would win it. They would make a higher one still, and he would immediately win that, too. The time passed in such meditations, and when the teacher came, the lesson about the adverbs of place and time and manner of action was not ready, and the teacher was not only displeased but hurt. This touched Seriosha. He felt he was not to blame for not having learned the lesson. However much he tried, he was utterly unable to do it. As long as the teacher was explaining to him, he believed him and seemed to comprehend it. But as soon as he was left alone, he was positively unable to recollect and to understand that the short and familiar word, suddenly, is an adverb of manner of action. Still, he was sorry that he had disappointed the teacher, and he was anxious to comfort him. He chose a moment when the teacher was looking in silence at the book. Mikhail Ivanich, when is your birthday? He asked all of a sudden. You'd much better be thinking about your work. Birthdays are of no importance to a rational being. It's a day like any other on which one has to do one's work. Seriosha looked intently at the teacher, at his scanty beard, at his spectacles, which had slipped down below the ridge on his nose, and fell into so deep a reverie that he heard nothing of what the teacher was explaining to him. He knew that the teacher did not think what he had said. He felt it from the tone in which it was said. But why have they all agreed to speak, just at the same manner, always the dreariest and most useless stuff? Why does he keep me off? Why doesn't he love me? He asked himself mournfully and could not think of an answer. Chapter 27. After the lesson with the teacher of grammar came his father's lesson. While waiting for his father, Seriosha sat at the table playing with a penknife and fell to musing. Among Seriosha's favorite occupations was searching for his mother during his walks. He did not believe in death generally, and in her death in particular, in spite of what Lydia Ivanovna had told him and his father had confirmed. And it was just because of that, and because he had been told she was dead, that he had begun looking for her when out for a walk. Every woman of full, graceful figure with dark hair was his mother. At sight of such a woman, such a feeling of tenderness stirred within him that his breath failed him and tears came into his eyes, and he was on tiptoe with expectation that she would come up to him and would lift her veil. All her face would be visible. She would smile. She would hug him. He would sniff her fragrance, feel the softness of her arms, and cry with happiness, just as he had one evening lean on her lap while she tickled him, and he laughed and bit her white, ring-covered fingers. Later, when he accidentally learned from his old nurse that his mother was not dead, and his father and Lydia Ivanovna had explained to him that she was dead to him because she was wicked, which he could not possibly believe because he loved her, he went on seeking her and expecting her in the same way. That day in the public gardens there had been a lady in a lilac veil whom he had watched with a throbbing heart, believing it to be her as she came toward them along the path. The lady had not come up to them but had disappeared somewhere. That day, more intensely than ever, Seriosha felt a rush of love for her, and now, waiting for his father, he forgot everything and cut all around the edge of the table with his penknife, staring straight before him with sparkling eyes and thinking of her. "Here is your papa," Vasily Lukitch diverted him. Seriosha jumped up and went up to his father, and kissing his hand, looked at him intently, trying to discover signs of his joy at receiving the Alexandra Nevsky. "Did you have a good walk?" said Alexey Alexandrovich, sitting down in his easy chair, pulling the volume of the Old Testament to him and opening it. Although Alexey Alexandrovich had more than once told Seriosha that every Christian ought to know Scripture history thoroughly, he often referred to the Bible himself during the lesson, and Seriosha observed this. "Yes, it was a very good idea, Papa," said Seriosha, sitting sideways on his chair and rocking it, which was forbidden. "I saw Nadinka." Nadinka was a niece of Lydia Ivanovna's, who was being brought up in her house. "She told me you'd been given a new star. Are you glad, Papa?" "First of all, don't rock your chair, please," said Alexey Alexandrovich. "And secondly, it's not the reward that's precious, but the work itself. And I could have wished you had understood that. If you now are going to work, to study, in order to win a reward, then the work will seem hard to you. But when you work," Alexey Alexandrovich, as he spoke, thought of how he had been sustained by a sense of duty through the wearisome labor of the morning, consisting of signing 180 papers. "Loving your work, you will find your reward for it." Seriosha's eyes, hitherto shining with gaiety and tenderness, grew dull and dropped before his father's gaze. This was the same long, familiar tone his father always took with him, and Seriosha had learned by now to fall in with it. His father always talked to him, so Seriosha felt as though he were addressing some boy of his own imagination, one of those boys who exist in books, utterly unlike himself, and Seriosha always tried before his father to pretend being the storybook boy. "You understand that, I hope," said his father. "Yes, Papa," answered Seriosha, acting the part of the imaginary boy. The lesson consisted of learning by heart several verses out of the Evangel and the repetition of the beginning of the Old Testament. The verses from the Evangel Seriosha knew fairly well, but at the moment when he was saying them, he became so absorbed in watching the sharply protruding, bony knobbiness of his father's forehead that he lost the thread and he transposed the end of one verse and the beginning of another. It was evident to Alexey Alexandrovich that he did not understand what he was saying, and this irritated him. He frowned and began explaining what Seriosha had heard many times before and never could remember because he understood it too well, just as that suddenly is an adverb of manner of action. Seriosha looked with scared eyes at his father and could think of nothing but whether his father would make him repeat what he had said, as he sometimes did. And this thought so alarmed Seriosha that he now understood nothing. But his father did not make him repeat it, and passed on to the lesson out of the Old Testament. Seriosha recounted the events themselves well enough, but when he had to answer questions as to what certain events prefigured, he knew nothing, though he had already been punished over this lesson. The passage at which he was utterly unable to say anything and began fidgeting and cutting the table and swinging his chair was where he had to tell of the patriarchs before the flood. He did not know one of them except Enoch, who had been taken up alive to heaven. Last time he had remembered their names, but now he had forgotten them utterly, chiefly because Enoch was the personage he liked best in the whole of the Old Testament, and Enoch's translation to heaven was connected in his mind with a whole long train of thought, in which he became absorbed now while he gazed with fascinated eyes at his father's watch chain and a half-unbuttoned button on his waistcoat. In death, of which they talked to him so often, Seriosha disbelieved entirely. He did not believe that those he loved could die, above all that he himself would die. That was to him something utterly inconceivable and impossible. But he had been told all men die. He had asked people, indeed, whom he trusted, and they, too, had confirmed it. His old nurse, too, said the same, though reluctantly. But Enoch had not died, and so it followed that everyone did not die. And why cannot anyone else so serve God and be taken alive to heaven, thought Seriosha. Bad people, that is, those Seriosha did not like, might die, but the good might all be like Enoch. Well, what are the names of the patriarchs? Enoch, Enos, but you have said that already. This is bad, Seriosha, very bad, if you don't try to learn what is most necessary of all for a Christian, said his father, getting up. Whatever can interest you. I am displeased with you, and Peter Ignatich, this was the chief pedagogue, is displeased with you. I shall have to punish you. His father and his teacher were both displeased with Seriosha, and he certainly did learn his lessons very badly. But still, it could not be said he was a stupid boy. On the contrary, he was far cleverer than the boys his teacher held up as examples to Seriosha. In his father's opinion, he did not want to learn what he was taught. In reality, he could not learn that. He could not because the claims of his own soul were more binding on him than those claims his father and his teacher made upon him. Those claims were in opposition, and he was in direct conflict with his governors. He was 9 years old. He was a child, but he knew his own soul. It was precious to him. He guarded it as the eyelid guards the eye. And without the key of love, he let no one into his soul. His teachers complained that he would not learn, while his soul was brimming over with thirst for knowledge. And he learned from Kapitinich, from his nurse, from Nadinka, from Vasily Lukich, but not from his teachers. The spring his father and his teachers reckoned upon to turn their mill wheels had long oozed at another place, and its waters did their work there. His father punished Seriosha by not letting him go to see Nadinka, Lydia Ivanovna's niece, but this punishment turned out happily for Seriosha. Vasily Lukich was in a good humor and showed him how to make windmills. The whole evening passed over this work and dreaming how to make a windmill on which he could turn himself, clutching at the wings or tying himself on and whirling around. Of his mother, Seriosha did not think all the evening, but when he had gone to bed, he suddenly remembered her and prayed in his own words that tomorrow his mother, in time for his birthday, might leave off hiding herself and come to him. Vasily Lukich, do you know what I prayed for tonight, extra, beside the regular things? That you might learn your lessons better? No. Boys? No. You'll never guess. A splendid thing, but it's a secret. When it comes to pass, I'll tell you. Can't you guess? No, I can't guess. You tell me, said Vasily Lukich with a smile, which was rare with him. Come, lie down. I'm putting out the candle. Without the candle, I can see better what I see and what I prayed for. There, I was almost telling the secret, said Seriosha, laughing gaily. When the candle was taken away, Seriosha heard his mother and felt her presence. She stood over him, and her loving gaze caressed him. But then came windmills, a penknife, everything became confused, and he fell asleep. Chapter 28. On arriving in Petersburg, Vronsky and Anna stayed at one of the best hotels, Vronsky apart in the lower story, Anna above with her child, its nurse and her maid in a large suite of four rooms. On the day of his arrival, Vronsky went to his brother's. There he found his mother, who had come from Moscow on business. His mother and sister-in-law greeted him as usual. They asked him about his stay abroad and talked of their common acquaintances, but did not let drop a single word in allusion to his connection with Anna. His brother came next morning to see Vronsky and of his own accord asked him about her. And Alexey Vronsky told him directly that he looked upon his connection with Madame Karenin as marriage, that he hoped to arrange a divorce and then to marry her. And until then, he considered her as much a wife as any other wife, and he begged him to tell their mother and his wife so. If the world disapproves, I don't care, said Vronsky. But if my relations want to be on terms of relationship with me, they will have to be on the same terms with my wife. The elder brother, who had always a respect for his younger brother's judgment, could not well tell whether he was right or not till the world had decided the question. For his part, he had nothing against it, and with Alexei he went up to see Anna. Before his brother, as before everyone, Vronsky addressed Anna with a certain formality, treating her as he might a very intimate friend, but it was understood that his brother knew their real relations, and they talked about Anna's going to Vronsky's estate. In spite of all his social experience, Vronsky was, in consequence of the new position in which he was placed, laboring under a strange misapprehension. One would have thought he must have understood that society was closed for him and Anna, but now some vague ideas had sprung up in his brain that this was only the case in old-fashioned days, and that now, with the rapidity of modern progress, he had unconsciously become by now a partisan of some sort of progress. The views of society had changed, and that the question of their reception by society was far from decided. Of course, he thought, she would not be received at court, but intimate friends can, and must, look at it in the proper light. One may sit for several hours at a stretch with one's legs crossed in the same position if one knows that there's nothing to prevent one's changing one's position. But if a man knows that he must remain sitting so with crossed legs, then cramps come on, the legs begin to twitch and to strain toward the spot to which one would like to draw them.